of the portfolio committee to today not have a long motivation. We need to ask questions and be direct to the questions because we don't have much time today. If we could please be out of here by 12:30. I notice Honorable De Freitas, you have your hand up.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. Good morning. One of the reasons why this meeting will probably go on longer than what we want it to be is because we're all getting these documents for the first time. So I'm totally unprepared. I haven't read anything. And we've discussed this kind of issue before. We present us if they want us to, you know, consider the issues. Time is for you. We need to get it in advance. I don't even mind getting it the night before so we can read it. I'm now getting a pile of documents that I haven't read, and I'm going into this blind, excepting for the stuff that we got in advance. So please, Madam Chair, let's ask these people in future, whenever they make presentations, that they hand their documents in on time. So now I'm going to probably ask stupid questions because I haven't read it. So I'm just a little put off about that. Thank you.
I agree with you, Honourable Member, because we always, request presenters to send their documents before the meeting so that members are able to go through the document and it becomes easier for us to engage when we've gone through the document before. So in future, we appeal that please let us have documents 3-4 days before the meeting so that we are able to familiarize ourselves with the documents. Over to you, Ma. You will introduce yourself before as we follow the same route of yesterday. You introducing yourself, members asking questions, you noting the questions and responding at the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sehira Jina and I'm representing the African Centre for Migration and Society at Wits University. I'm a researcher at that institution. Good morning, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen. Before starting my presentation, I'll first introduce who we are and where this testimony is coming from. The ACMS, or African Centre for Migration and Society, is a research, training and outreach body based at Wits University. And through its research, training, teaching and outreach, it has worked with the South African Presidency, the SALGA, Departments of Labour, Health, Social Development and SSA to improve their responses to human mobility and to mainstream migration management across the centre. We at ACMS welcome this opportunity, Madam Chair, to further our common commitment to developing and implementing pragmatic policies that address perennial problems that South Africa faces: joblessness, poor wages and labour conditions, inequality and physical insecurity. As academics, as social scientists, as researchers, our role is neither to condemn nor condone. We are not here to criticise any government or any policy in particular, but to offer critical reflections based on objective, original, evidence-based research in comparison with regional and global experiences. Our testimony today emerges from our belief that with the right policy frameworks and administrative structures, human migration can help realize the South Africa we all wish for, rather than work against it. That is, a country where its residents, all of them, live in dignity, free from fear and poverty. To achieve these ends, an effective migration policy, we believe, should minimize the number of undocumented migrants, promote equal and equitable participation for all in the labour force, nationals and non-nationals, ensure that migration contributes rather than detracts from growth and job creation, and finally, allow for an asylum system that provides protection for those who are genuinely in need. We do not claim to have the knowledge to achieve these ends, and indeed we should be sceptical of those who provide all the answers. However, research in South Africa and examples from elsewhere help us to explore possible scenarios, challenge dubious presumptions that inform the current policy direction, and point to processes and questions that can guide us as we move forward together. although this short presentation and accompanying text that was submitted to the portfolio committee is based on extensive research and analysis, this testimony today is not intended as an exhaustive technical report, and we at ACMS remain committed to engaging with the Department of Home Affairs and other stakeholders in providing additional documentation, references, and research if it's so needed. So let's consider this, the dark hole of securitization. Although the government and the Department of Home Affairs in particular has yet to reveal the results of its long-awaited policy review, there are strong clues as to the orientation of future migration policies. I speak a little bit about the likely outcomes of the heightened controls on immigration and greater restrictions on those seeking asylum that have been hinted at in the ANC's peace and stability discussion document, and which was largely endorsed during the ANC's recent policy conference in Mangaung. Based on South African and comparative evidence and examples, there are strong reasons to believe that if implemented, the securitization of migration management, and by this I mean a process of increased border controls, restrictive entry, and more detention and deportation, is actually a lose-lose for everyone concerned. Based on our research, we believe that there's strong evidence to suggest that securitization of migration management will worsen conditions for the country's citizenry, foster criminality and corruption, threaten the rights of asylum seekers and refugees, which, as you heard yesterday, we have an international obligation to protect, and counterintuitively, actually increase the number of undocumented migrants in South Africa, something I think everyone wants to avoid. Let's consider the last point, that of increasing numbers, by looking at two examples, the European Union and the United States, and I can provide references on these studies if you so need. Over the last decade, both regions have greatly expanded their border control initiatives through a combination of militarization, technology, sensors, extraterritorial patrols, interception and detention centers. What has this resulted in? Although there's been an increase in the number of arrests and deportations, the number of undocumented migrants, as a result, has actually not decreased. In fact, it has increased. What has happened is that despite the government's attempts to tighten fences, people are staying longer once they've crossed the border because it's more difficult to come in, and may actually work to bring over family members whom they can no longer visit because of the restrictions of movement. It's also worth noting that the European system has increased the level of risk migrants are ready to take, resulting in about 28,000 deaths at sea per year in the EU case. There have been similar increases in deaths along the US-Mexico border as people take ever more dangerous journeys across mountains and deserts. The key lesson from these comparative examples is that devoting significant resources and constrained resources in this country, I might add, into increased border control does little to reduce migrant numbers, but actually carries significant risks, both for migrants and host countries alike. So let's look at some of those risks and negative outcomes on the citizenry. What about the effects on wages and employment? Here a number of issues come into play. First, given that securitization is unlikely to reduce the number of undocumented migrants, as seen in the EU and the US example, there is little chance that it will improve labor conditions for citizens. Moreover, because undocumented migrants face more severe sanctions for protesting poor labor conditions and are harder to unionize or otherwise organize, their participation in the labor force is likely to further push down wages. This makes South Africans worse off than if the migrants were documented and in the formal system. The lack of documentation also means that people are typically underemployed, wasting precious opportunities in utilizing skills and transferring skills. Lastly, without access to credit or bank accounts, people have few options but to continue working in low income and precarious positions. By effectively excluding them from opportunities to save and invest, South Africa further misses out on their potential economic contributions. These might not necessarily be outcomes of migration per se, but they are likely to be outcomes of increasingly restrictive control. question about criminality and physical security. Here too, attempts to securitize national migration processes are likely to undermine citizens' physical security. There are many reasons for this. First, people without documents are unlikely to go to the police when they are victimized. They're also likely to stay out of formal databases and police systems. That many of the unbanked carry cash also means that they're ideal targets for criminals, and as such, criminals are unlikely to be reported, investigated, charged, or convicted. This only enables criminality and violence in communities, which everyone is desperate to avoid. They are also less easily detected themselves when engaged in illicit activities, an issue that is receiving increasing attention in public discourses. Second, undocumented migrants remain highly vulnerable to extortion at the hands of police, border guards, and other security officials. Already, the discretion provided to such officials has resulted in extraordinarily high levels of administrative irregularities. While not everyone necessarily will be upset by the considerable abuse and bribery migrants face at the hands of police or other state officials, we should all be concerned at the perverse incentive structures such opportunities create. Our researcher, Madam Speaker, has estimates that Gauteng-based police spend approximately one-fourth of their human resources budget on immigration issues. This money is doing little to make the police, the province, safer. Rather, we are effectively subsidizing various forms of harassment and resource extraction from what the police jokingly term mobile ATMs. As foreigners are no more likely than South Africans to be involved in crime, this does little to make us safer. Moreover, as the police busy themselves shaking down and detaining foreigners, criminals are given space to work. But such criminality is not limited to towns and cities. Current proposals to further militarize the border closely follow those already implemented in the United States, and the results there have been predictable and sober. An escalation of violence between border guards and smugglers, more sophisticated cross-border criminal syndicates, additional deaths of border crossers, and as noted, no significant decline in illegal trade or entry. Organized crime and petty criminality is something everybody wants to work against and can be reduced through police intelligence and anti-corruption measures, not through tightened border control. So as we move forward and develop policies that aim to do this, let's look at some of the current problematic presumptions that underlie current thinking in policy development. How is it that we have moved so far towards securitization without recognizing the considerable risks that such a process poses? Well, there's almost certainly domestic interests who would like to see us go in this direction. A defense force looking for work, business and individuals keen on new and renewed tenders, and officials offering citizens false hopes of overcoming continued economic and physical insecurity. Interests the board also wish South Africa to be the first line of defense against migration to Europe and beyond. Before we go further, we should recognize that the securitization path has already been paved by wealthier countries, who have plowed more resources than South Africa might commit, and which have failed to realize the misguided promises of prosperity and security. And it is precisely these promises and the presumptions guiding these that we now consider. So there's a number of these presumptions that I want to draw your attention to. The first is the misplaced belief that South Africa is being overwhelmed with ever-growing numbers of migrants and asylum seekers. A closer look at the numbers does much to deflate these exaggerated estimates. First, asylum numbers have escalated in large part because there's no effective way for economic migrants to enter South Africa legally if they don't have what's termed scarce skills or high skills. If we were to create mechanisms for Zimbabweans to enter South Africa, asylum numbers would drop to easily manageable numbers. We've already seen that happening after the Zimbabwean documentation process. The partial stabilization of Zimbabwe also has resulted in a 64% decrease in asylum applications in 2011. This is from the Department of Home Affairs asylum statistics. as for international migration and migrants generally, the actual numbers say a different story to what's commonly believed. The recently released 2011 census figures are far more modest. 1,692,242 foreigners out of a total population of almost 50 million. This results in non-nationals making up less than 4% of the country's population. Of course, you may say that this is an undercount, and it might indeed be so, but even so, the total percentage is unlikely to top 4%. A number much lower than other countries even in the region. Both Namibia and Botswana both have non-nationals who make up about 5% of the population. Despite being the region's uncontested economic powerhouse, these numbers are small compared not just to the region, as I've mentioned, but also to Australia, Europe, and the United States, which all have non-national populations of around 10%. We must also look carefully at current policies, which are often accused of being too permissive. When examined closely, the Immigration Act of 2002 is already remarkably restrictive by global standards, let alone for a newfound democracy committed to human rights and regional integration. Under the Act and its various amendments, it's almost impossible for residents of other countries to legally seek work in South Africa. Although there are a few options for the wealthy and the highly skilled, the recent amendments to the Act make even skilled migration more difficult. The problem, honourable members, is that our Immigration Act is not too permissive, but it is too crude, it's too blunt. By denying avenues for legal entry, avenues that could be beneficial for South Africa and its citizenry, as we heard yesterday, we ensure that people continue to enter illegally and at great cost to themselves, South Africans, and to South Africa. There are also reasons to be wary of promises that the military or others can prevent migration. As we heard yesterday, migration cannot be stopped. South Africa already deports tens of thousands of people a year. Between 1994 and 2012, 3 million people were deported. This is not an effective policy financially, as confirmed by Minister Pandor's recent comment that the country is spending 19 million rand a year on a deportation policy that does not work. Such expenditures enrich stakeholders in COSATA and others associated with detention and transport of deportees, but have little substantive impact on the issues that most South Africans care about, jobs and crime. As noted earlier, the United States has spent billions of dollars on a wall, on helicopters and security guards, without substantially reducing migration from Mexico and Central America. Through its Frontex initiative, Europe has followed a parallel course with similar consequences. In most cases, it's only the faltering economies of the host country that have encouraged people to go home or stay away. What securitization measures have accomplished, by contrast, is to foster corruption, violence, and organized crime along the borders and at sea. This is real research, real evidence, which points to the outcomes of the securitization policy. The final presumption around migration, and perhaps the one that's most difficult to dislodge, is that migration inherently undermines South Africa's economic security and possibilities for job creation. Global evidence from Europe and North America is ambiguous at best about the effects of migration on the economy. Certainly, some will lose out, but if properly managed, more will benefit. A sound migration policy, therefore, honourable members, means that the positive is far more likely to outweigh the cost. Although immigration may present more direct competition in the South African context, and we've been hearing anecdotal evidence of this yesterday, there are a number of important factors to keep in mind. Given the relatively small number of international migrants, even effectively excluding them from the labor force will only have marginal impacts on the overall employment or wage rate. By ensuring that migrants are working illegally, we only maximize potential negative consequences, as I said. Migrants, even those that do work outside of formal systems, often contribute in ways that generate wealth and jobs for South Africa. This is most obvious when they import scarce fields, but we shouldn't overlook the value of trade, investment, VAT, and other contributions. And migrants of all skill levels can play an important role in improving South Africa's overall economic position by contributing to a robust regional economy. In 2012, migrants to South Africa transferred approximately 9.7 billion rand to their families and communities in 17 countries. If we are serious about a regional economy, then we should take the inhabitants of that regional economy more seriously. Much of this cash is used to fund education, investment, and consumption across the region. We are only now beginning to understand the potential positive impacts of such exchange, and we should be wary of cutting it off before we do. So what processes are there for positive reform? Honourable members, as we look forward, there is no magic formula for ensuring that migration policy contributes to improving South Africa's welfare and safety. Indeed, as I mentioned, there is no single answer or optimal migration policy. There will always be compromises and uncertainties. If nothing else, this testimony indicates that current policy directions are unlikely to further these aims and contribute to better South Africa. Moreover, any policy is likely to fail if founded on faulty presumptions about the nature and degree of threat that migration and migrants pose, and if it lacks widespread support from stakeholders across South Africa, both within the state and also the non-state actors who have been here these last 2 days. With the improved data and dispassionate analysis, we may nonetheless move towards more pragmatic and pro-poor policy frameworks. And we offer a few practical suggestions on how to enable this. First, to entrench the role of the Immigration Advisory Board while expanding its extra-governmental membership and enhancing its advisory functions to matters of policy and policy reform, rather than limiting its position to reviewing regulations and bureaucratic innovation. Secondly, to reinforce labour inspectors within the Department of Labour, to capacitate them, ensure that they have knowledge on migration and migration-related issues as much as they have knowledge on working conditions in South Africa, and to ensure equality of remuneration and treatment of workers and foreign workers. To dedicate resources within the departments of art and culture, education, and health and social development to fight against xenophobia and educate populations, organized labor, and civil servants. This fight must go beyond education campaigns, which, while important, do little to address the economic and political incentives for continued violence. Finally, to establish a program which is a formal multi-stakeholder platform dedicated to migration, aimed at improving the collection of international migration data and facilitate access to this well-maintained data state by state and non-state actors alike, including, these are some suggestions, NEDLAC, the Departments of Labor, SALGA, ILO, Statistics South Africa, the Chamber of Commerce, SARS, and Social Development, as well as the members within this room. And beyond these measures, there are several questions that we should keep in mind as we consider new policy options and proposals. And I hope, honourable members, that you ask yourself these questions as we look at the current state of immigration policy and its outcomes in South Africa and South Africans, as well as non-nationals. Are the policy's objectives clearly stated? Are they developmental and pro-poor? And are the presumptions underlying this policy supported by objective research and evidence? Have the proposals been forged in consultation and with the support of key stakeholders from organized labor, business, concerned government departments, NGOs, academics, expert analysis, legal practitioners, and regional partners? More pointedly, do the proposals reflect the interests of these stakeholders, or has consultation fallen short? Or do they pursue a more narrowly defined set of goals that fails to take into account the broader context? Do the proposed policy reforms include a clear methodology and time frame for implementation? Concrete programs for addressing existing and potential administrative challenges? estimated costs for implementation, estimated aggregate and sector effects for the local, the national, and the regional economy, and plans to reverse brain drain, promote skills transfer, and retain qualified skills. As we rethink our immigration system, honorable members, the commitment to providing asylum should not be compromised in an effort to control immigration. Rather, we must recognize that the overwhelming asylum numbers are primarily indicative of the country's failure to provide effective mechanisms for the migration of lesser skilled migrants, which this country historically has relied upon, particularly in key sectors such as mining and agriculture. Until such mechanisms are instituted, migrants will continue to take their chances, whilst with the asylum system in ways that compromise its ability to function. In doing so, they contribute to the country's administrative burden and jeopardize the safety of those truly in need of protection and as refugees. So I thank you once again for this opportunity and welcome further engagement.
Thank you for your presentation, Zahira. Honorable members, time for questions and comments. But this is what the honorable member said earlier on, that the submission of late documents actually implicating on members to be able to engage with the presenters, because we are now receiving the documents now, and we must ask questions and start engaging with you, of which is a bit difficult because we have just received the documents now. Honorable members, time for questions. Honorable directors, Honorable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, first of all, thank you to the Centre for giving us documents in advance, which I had read and I'm prepared for, so thank you for that. But I do ask, firstly, if we don't mind, perhaps through our committee secretary, to get us a copy of your presentation, which basically is a summary of the document. So thank you for that. The first is just some comments and then a question. And that is, the first is, has there been any interaction with the department in creating the policy? And, or any kind of consultation, whatever the case is, and if so, in what form, and what has the reaction from the department been? Secondly, I'll ask the questions first. The asylum numbers that you're talking about, I find most interesting. You're talking about the tops 4%. Where do you obtain this information? Because, I would imagine it's very difficult to obtain real statistics. I'm very interested in how you got that. And then just some comments, and that is that, let me just say that what you say in your documents is the language that I speak. We have a great paranoia in general in this country about foreigners. Let me just immediately say that we don't want the bad people. We don't want the drug dealers, we don't want the criminals, we don't want the people who can destroy and negatively impact our economy. So let's get that out of the way. But we do want the people who've got skills, who can contribute to this economy, who can grow, who can skill transfer, and so forth. You talk about 9 billion and so forth. So we need to change the mindset. Secondly, the successful countries in the world, all successful countries in the world, have grown because they've allowed external skills, external talent, other people from other countries, they've welcomed them with open arms and allowed them to build the country hand in hand. So we need to change that mindset. The fact that, for example, a foreigner is contravening bylaws is not a reason for kicking them out. It's to ensure that they've got to comply with bylaws. They've got to comply with the laws of the land. They want to live in South Africa, they've got to comply with South African laws. However, we must make it as easy and as slick and as welcoming as possible for them to come to South Africa to help us grow, reduce poverty, grow our economy, and so forth. And then the last point is I want to just highlight the section that you call Points to Ponder, and that is exactly, I think, I draw my colleagues' attention to look at that, because I think those are very important points to ponder. That's it. Thanks very much, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a very interesting presentation, and it's good to see there's some statistics and proper research being done. Certainly a very good resource base on your page 7. I have 3 questions for Ms. Jinnah. The first one is on page 2. You raise the question, and in fact, you do say strong reasons to believe. So you do, as we say, don't tie yourself. That securitization of migration management will worsen conditions. Now, why do you necessarily think that will happen? It seems to me the alternative is no recording, no border controls. We must allow people to swarm into our country, if that is the right word, to come and get equal pay, minimum wages, and that comes up again on page 6, where you say they must get the same. I wonder if Ms. Jinnah is aware of where many of these people are coming from, and their perception is that South Africa's streets are paved with gold. So my concern is, do you really expect a responsible government not to have securitization? I think you can debate the level and how you manage it and what you do, but that's the first thing. If you can unpack what you understand by securitization, and if you were Minister Pandor, what you would like to have happen in South Africa. The second question is from page 5, where you are concerned about job creation and the view that it inherently undermines South Africa's economic security and possibilities for job creation. The reality, as I understand, of the refugee situation, whether they're coming into the United States or Europe, the immigration into those countries, and even a country like Israel, has got serious migration out of Africa, is because the people want a better life. And they presume there is a better life. So they are looking for any job, not a decent job. And our joblessness in South Africa is because we've defined a job as decent work. An immigrant doesn't mind. He's a bottom feeder. He or she will happily take any job, not a decent work. So that's my second question is it realistic for you to suggest that? And then you suggest there be inspectors and that they must manage the situations. Are you going to find those funds from the Gauteng police that you allege spend a quarter of their resources on immigration issues, which is an interesting one? And then finally on page 6, you also, sorry, can I just, I'm not quite sure, maybe you must unpack developmental. Also your qualifications, progressive and pro-Moore, because developmental can mean, and perhaps you can explain to us, the social engineering with a hard left agenda. And if, you know, if that's what you understand by it, then how it is going to assist the refugees who are coming from poverty-stricken countries, if you could explain that. Could I finally say, Madam Chair, and maybe Ms. Jinnah could comment on that, is that a large number of immigrants, I'm not saying refugees and asylum seekers, and I think you've made the point that asylum seeking is the only way people can get a legal basis, but there are a large number of immigrants and also many of the refugees who come with very considerable skills. Now, does she suggest in terms of securitization how one distinguishes between those two categories?
Thank you, Honourable Member. On page 4 of your presentation, you are stating that border control will not reduce organized crime or other petty criminal activity, but I don't share that with you. I have a different view, because just here in Lesotho, we have a problem of stock theft between the two countries. So if you could maybe further expand to what you mean by that. And if you can tell us which country has no border control method, maybe we could learn from there as to how can we deal with the issue of border control. You may respond to questions that are posed by members. Any more questions, Honourable Members? Honourable Member.
Suggesting that a generic one, of course, listen to the presentation, just to tie on the loose ends from what my colleagues have asked. What you tend to get as an emphasis is that when you look at the immigrants, especially the illegal immigrants, you don't see how we get the advice, because this is an opportunity that we want dialogue, we want to engage in a manner that will assist us as putting the policy together. One seeks to understand, given the fact that we have undocumented citizens, undocumented foreigners, so to speak, how do you see it proper that we can manage that situation, thereby informing the actual number of people that are in South Africa, which we don't know, as by the illegal immigrants? You can go wherever in the documents, in the archives, you'll never find in our country where we can say definitely this is the number of undocumented people, because they are undocumented. But you made reference that the people that are not South Africans account for less than 4%. Now, I would wonder whether that is valid. I think the department is here to qualify that statement. The other question, Chair, is the whole area of the police spending all their efforts to search for illegal migrants. I used to hear of some random actions, back in the days where we were tortured and chased by the police forces because they were looking for guerrillas who were hidden. But I don't think in these days you would find that police would go around searching for people who are not necessarily South Africans. But if that is the case, we'd like to understand whether there is evidence to that effect. What is the case in point, whether it's an anecdotal example that we can use, so that we can then engage the Department of Police and the whole security cluster to deal with that matter. Chair, I think that's my bite for now. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Over to you, Ms. Jenny.
Thank you very much for the comments and questions. We'll start first around engagement with the Department of Home Affairs, which has been a very difficult process. ACMS, as an independent academic institution, remains committed to establishing and maintaining fruitful engagement with a variety of stakeholders. And of course, we realize that the Department of Home Affairs is a very critical one. There have been numerous attempts made at various levels to engage formally with the Department of Home Affairs on not just the research agenda that ACMS has, but also in terms of the Department of Home Affairs informing that research agenda. and using the knowledge produced by the center in its own policy processes and administrative structures. That efforts at engagement has taken various forms directly between the ACMS and the Home Affairs Department in Johannesburg. At project level, through particularly the Labour Migration Project, which is a new initiative funded by the South African EU Dialogue Facility, of which the National Treasury is a key partner. And also through the partnerships the ACMS has with SELGA, SNESSA, and the Department of Labour. Despite all of these efforts, the Department of Home Affairs has not provided a commitment to engage with us. We have consistently repeated that we maintain an open door policy to the Department of Home Affairs, and I would like to take this opportunity to invite them once again to engage with us formally, constructively, towards achieving the aims that I think we all have in common, managing migration positively for the country, as well as for South Africans and non-nationals, and I'd like to place that on record. Regarding the issue of data, I'm not sure if I heard correctly, but the 4% of the population is not the total of asylum, because it's the total of non-nationals, regardless of status. So it's 3.3% of all people in South Africa are born outside of this country, and that's data obtained from the recently released initial round of census 2011 figures. Regarding the validity and reliability of those figures, as Honourable Member has pointed out, I think that's a question that Statistics South Africa needs to answer. But certainly these are, for the first time, nationwide figures revealed at that scale, which put the number of non-nationals in this country at significantly lower than what is commonly assumed. Migration at the detriment of the citizenry. I think it's important to note, Honourable Members, that migrants and refugees having access to rights is not at the cost of citizens having access to rights. Rights are not something we divide and bargain over. They're something that everybody has. And as the Honourable Member has pointed out, many nations have succeeded, particularly because of migrants. And therefore, migration needs to be seen as a joint effort at benefiting the country and not as something that involves a small portion of the population only. Honourable Member McIntosh. Regarding defining securitization, I think it's a process at which we've seen some hints in the Department of Home Affairs policy reviews. It's defined as increased border control, so putting more resources, more manpower, more physical infrastructure on the borders to keep people out, increasing detention and deportation. We've seen numbers at Lindela increase. So Lindela is a detention facility. An increase in the number of deportations. I've mentioned the figures of how many people South Africa deports and at what cost. Those are generally accepted definitions of securitization. I want to state on record, as I believe it's been stated yesterday before, that moving away from securitization does not in any way suggest an open border policy. Nobody is stating that we should open the borders. Rather, what we are saying is that we should have a policy and a process in place that enables movement of people through regular channels, so that they remain within the system, as it were, and that they can make contributions in formal ways, and that also if they are to fall short of the law in any way, that they would be within the system rather than operating outside of it. I believe Honourable Member McIntosh, as well as others, have asked, and Madam Chair, to answer your question as well, which countries in the world have no borders? Or have no border management. Of course, there are none, and we're not suggesting that there should be. That should be the case. South Africa should follow. What we are looking at is rather two points here. So first, that securitization in the EU and in the United States has not reduced migration. It has increased the number of undocumented migrants. We know that. That's a fact. And if our policy direction is based on the failed efforts of other countries, then we're already setting off on the wrong foot. Regarding examples where the opposite might have been, there are two. The East African states, of which there are 5 members, and ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, which has 15 members, have both adopted free movement protocols within their structures. The results of these are still too early to determine. But in essence, they are moving from a presumption that's the opposite of keeping people out. They're moving from the presumption that mobility and movement within the region is actually beneficial for member states within that regional bloc, as well as for citizens and for the migrants themselves. And perhaps it's worth noting that we should be rather looking at what these new initiatives might tell us as we ponder our own policy choices, rather than being stuck on where it has disastrously failed. Undocumented migrants are indeed bad for the country. They're bad for South Africans. They're bad for migrants. They push down wages, which essentially means that South Africans lose out on wages. If we have migrants that are documented and if we have a labor conditions that are implemented, we are raising the bar of decent living to, I think, what we should all aspire to. So rather than looking at what's currently taking place, I think migration policy needs to aspire to ambitions, needs to aspire to values and principles that we as a country want to move toward. And we should therefore look at setting the bar, for example, for decent work, for living wages, for labor conditions, and ensure that mechanisms such as undocumented migration do not detract from that standard that we wish to set. Honourable Member McIntosh mentioned the police and whether they would have the capacity to inspect labour conditions. I don't believe that's their function. I believe that's the function of the Department of Labour, who at national level have expressed commitment to improving their capacity and their knowledge in being able to undertake labour inspections more consistently, but also to take into account issues that foreign workers might bring that would affect all workers. And as a partner in the Labour Migration Research Project, which I mentioned, the Department of Labour is committed to that. I think the question of whether they have sufficient budget to undertake that is outside of this current agenda. But certainly needs to be taken up in different fora where it's more appropriate. Developmental, I think it's certainly not a social engineering that's leaning towards the left. I think it's a developmental policy that takes into consideration the needs of all that are affected. So not driven by business, not driven by the private sector or by politicians, not driven by foreign interests, but driven by the realities on the ground, by those that ultimately have to live with the outcomes of policies, whether they're nationals, in most cases they are, or they're non-nationals. And a developmental agenda which is pro-poor in its character essentially takes into account the needs of everyone and tries to balance that so that most people win. I think currently the developmental agenda has largely left out large chunks of the population, particularly the poor and the marginalized, including not just migrants, international migrants, but also internal migrants. A number of our studies have shown that internal migrants, people coming from the rural areas to cities in South Africa, are doing worse off than South Africans who are there. And I think any developmental agenda also needs to take into consideration the needs of that group. Madam Chair, I think I've addressed your comment around regions that we should look at for better examples. I think we need to note that policy must be informed by evidence-based research rather than personal views. I believe everyone has personal views, and that's what makes the lively and vibrant democracy that we have. But it would be problematic if policy, which has an impact on the lives of everybody, not just for the foreseeable future, but or longer term, if that sort of policy would be informed by anecdotal evidence and personal views rather than research and evidence-based knowledge. And I would urge honourable members to try and access research that would inform their policy deliberations. Regarding the question around the number of undocumented migrants, certainly I think by the very nature it's difficult to establish how many undocumented migrants there are. The only figures we have, the latest figures we have at the moment, suggests that the number of non-nationals in this country, regardless of documentation status, is less than 4%. Certainly this might be an undercount, but I think it's in the absence of actual data, in the absence of actual numbers, it would be difficult to presume that undocumented migrants are so many, and without any evidence, to assume further that they would be responsible for all the problems that this country faces, from joblessness to crime, to problems in housing and healthcare. We don't know how many they are. We don't know where they are. Are we then fueled by paranoia rather than actual evidence? Regarding the references for policing, this is not based on anecdotal research. This is based on a long-term, multi-year research project which investigated policing in Johannesburg. There are two particular references I can draw your attention to now, and I would be happy to send further reports to you for interrogation. There are reports done by Julia Hornberger and Darshan Vigneswaran. And there is also an African cities survey which the ACMS conducted in collaboration with the French Institute and Tufts University in 2006, which essentially did a survey of around 1,000 people in four African cities, one of which was Johannesburg, the other was Cape Town, the other two outside the country, all of which showed that migrants, regardless of documentation or not, and I'm sure members in this room will be able to testify to that, face arbitrary harassment from police officials on the street. In some cases, recognized refugees, and we should bear in mind always that recognized refugees are a legal category to which this country has an international obligation, as was stated by the UNHCR yesterday. But even recognized refugees face harassment, arbitrary arrest and detention at the hands of police. So these are facts which I can share with you now, and I can certainly provide further documentation to you for your inspection, and I hope for continued engagement. Thank you, Madam Chair.
How are recognized refugees being harassed? Don't they have documents? Can you explain why? How?
Do you want to respond right now?
Yeah.
Okay, sure. So they are harassed in a number of ways. Firstly, some refugees do not carry their permits with them all the time. It might be difficult to carry your permit with you as you're going about your daily business all the time if you're using public transportation. If they are suspected of being foreign, they are often ordered out of public spaces, for example, taxis, stopped on the street if they look different or speak a different language, asked to produce documentation. Then there are two scenarios. They might have documentation on them, in which case they are still not released from harassment. There have been reported incidents where refugees with correct documentation on them have been jeered at, have been interrogated and told that their permits are fake, have been interrogated as to how they got their permits, as to the content of their permits. At times, police officials confiscate the documents, as we heard yesterday as well, and non-nationals and refugees in particular have to pay bribes to receive their documents back. In instances when they don't have documentation, for example, they would say that my documentation is at home, it's with my employer, it's with my brother for safekeeping, they would be taken and detained until somebody can come and release them, where they would be harassed continuously, sometimes detained for longer than 24, 36 hours. So I think that the point here is not the human rights violations, although I think that's considerable. I think many South Africans face similar indignities in their in their daily struggles to live in South Africa. The point here is that why is the South African police force, with its constrained resources, spending so much of their time and their money on checking the permits of people and on trying to elicit bribes from them? And I think the issue of corruption is particularly worrying in this context, and it's something we know very little about, given that migrants are, and particularly migrants are more vulnerable in South African society due to the xenophobic violence that we all know about and others.
Thank you. I'm sure we've come to the end of the presentation by Ms. Gina. One question, no motivation, directly.
I said it's a rare opportunity, you know, but having listened to this motivation, which I'm not going to motivate, it is reminiscent to what we've seen on TV, we've read on the newspapers and listened on radio in PE yesterday, you know, I don't know how many days ago, where summarily one goes and say you are a Somali, then you don't belong here, you are illegal. Then you are Somali, you don't own these things legally. Come, let's go to the police station. And the Home Affairs and the police tend to collide, tend to be in collusion with each other in terms of this kind of perceived action. So hence, I think that report is very much important that we do actually sit and interrogate whether these trends are in fact interested in all communities as you go around the country, or is that an anecdotal kind of an example, as I was making references to earlier. So, Chair, that's the only qualification I wanted to make to that submission. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gina, for your
Chair, my question is one. Are we talking migration or we're talking refugee asylum seeker policy? Because we seem to be concentrating on that. So I thought we were going to have a broad framework in terms of what do we want pertaining to the entire migration policy. So I think that has to be clarified as to whether this is about migration policy or asylum seeker. What's to understand that they form part of the entire migration, but we seem to be focusing more on that, and we are losing out on the policy issue for the entire migration.
Migration, you know, we're talking on issues of migration, they include the asylum seekers, refugees, and all of them. Honourable members, I want to thank Ms. Gina for her presentation. I'm sure we will continue having interaction with your institution regarding matters of migration, mission, power, policy. Thank you very much. May we have the next presenter, which is the Human Rights Media Center. Over to you, ma. Introducing yourself. Chairperson, members of the committee, and
to committee member De Freitas's comment about the late submission. We have submitted the intervention report on the 22nd of January, and you should have received it from the Human Rights Media Center and Rwandans refugees living in Cape Town. Furthermore, we have given every member of the committee this book called Torn Apart. You didn't get it? You got it? I hope that you've read the stories or are beginning to read the stories. I would like to refer you to page 122 that has a story, a full life story of a Rwandan refugee living in Cape Town. Eddie himself said reading personal stories has changed his perception about refugees. And I think this is the value of personal testimony. My presentation here today, I do jointly with Rwandan refugees living in Cape Town. It's an organization. I will give the presentation, and when it comes to questions and comments, I hope my colleagues here in this room will add and respond. I'd like to introduce Salim, the two persons to my left. He's the chairperson of this organization. Let me go to the next slide. Without repeating any of the comments that were made yesterday, we would just like to add our voice and agree with the following. The Refugee Act of 1998 is progressive. Refugees are not confined to camps and can build livelihoods. Furthermore, we acknowledge the tremendous effort made by refugees to survive here in South Africa, pursue their education, and fend for their families' needs. Let me just at this point, and I failed to do so in the beginning. My name is Shirley Gunn. I think it's Honourable Member Dudu, Chairperson, who said yesterday that she was a refugee and that she was in a camp in Angola. I was also in a camp in Angola, and I don't claim to be a refugee. However, my experience has deepened my understanding and sensitivity to the issues that refugees face. I was referring to your comment yesterday. If I think I've got your name correctly, Honourable Member Dudu, am I right? No? Yes? Okay. I'm not a refugee, but I was also in Angola, in the bush. Okay. And but my experience helps me to understand the issues that refugees face, but I wasn't a refugee. I was a freedom fighter prepared to die for our democracy and our freedom here. I survived. So we furthermore agree that information and educational programs are necessary for the integration of refugees in local communities. We agree that maroon IDs that look something like this on the cover of your book pose limitations to the real independence of refugees and must be addressed. Better management and administration of the Act's implementation is at the core. Monitoring of operations is a joint responsibility of government and stakeholders. Furthermore, we agree that refugee reception centers, need to stay in place, not to be shut down, and that the personnel must be better trained, and there must be effective administration. borders is critical to the development of policy and migration, and that membership-based organizations like Rwandan refugees living in Cape Town must be included. There are others in KZN and Gauteng, and there's a national structure called the Rwandan Platform for Dialogue, Truth and Justice. These organizations should be included in the dialogue. Oh, Honorable Mr. Chairperson. I would like to respond to Honorable Member McIntosh's comment and add it to this list that any job, a bottom feeder job, a refugee is happy to have. I don't know about you what your qualifications are, but I've got a social science degree. I've specialized in social work and community work. I would swallow my pride if I had to stand as a car guard. I would be miserable because I wouldn't be doing the things that I'm trained to do, but I would do it because I have to feed my family. So let us be careful that we've got, we mustn't assume that people are happy doing that, they just have to do it and swallow their pride. What a painful thing to do. So this is, I don't think any refugee thinks that South Africa is paved with gold. I'm just responding to some of your comments. We've got a highly skilled base within refugee community that should be properly deployed and employed. So we would agree with all of these things. These have been said yesterday. I'm going to proceed now. And I'm not going to belabor, give you too much detail because I know that you're overloaded. We're going to focus on the cessation clause because it's one of the durable solutions put forward by the UNHCR and focuses on Rwanda as a case study. We've submitted the intervention report. I think Eddie can give you a copy if you haven't received it. Today you've got a summary copy because I'm very aware of how committee members can be overloaded with information and we don't want to do that to you. But it is available. The long report and the short report is available today and you can contact us afterwards if you haven't, if you have any questions. Let me go into this question of cessation. Since 2002, the government of Rwanda has been requesting UNHCR to invoke the cessation clause for Rwandan refugees. Once the cessation clause is put in place, refugee status of Rwandan refugees ceases to exist. The Rwandan refugees then either have to return to Rwanda or acquire permanent residency in the country where they sought protection, in this case, South Africa. Exceptions are made for some Rwandans on the grounds of past persecution. You don't have to look in the board because there's nothing on the board for you to look at. You can rather listen. In 2009, UNHCR declared that it considered invoking the cessation clause for Rwandan refugees in 2011, but after a series of intervention reports from international NGOs, reputable ones, the deadline was moved to 30 June 2013. The cessation clause will only count for refugees who fled Rwanda between 1959 and 1998 because UNHCR acknowledges that refugees who fled after 1998 may still have well-founded fears of persecution. In other words, we can still expect to receive Rwandan refugees seeking asylum. According to the government of Rwanda, the country is safe for refugees to return to, contrary to many international reports and the intervention report that you have received from us, that argue that the cessation clause for Rwandan refugees is not a favorable or durable solution as Rwanda is not safe. I had the privilege of going to Rwanda for 8 days last month. I used every single skill I learned in Cuba related to counter-surveillance and security to get in and out of the country safely. This is true, what you are reading. The call for the cessation clause of the Rwandan government and the UNHCR has caused anxiety in the Rwandan refugee community. The fact that the South African government has not provided a formal response to the call of the cessation clause increases stress, as Rwandan refugees living in South Africa are uncertain about their future. If South Africa chooses to invoke the cessation clause, Rwandan refugees will be forced to choose between repatriation or local integration. Repatriation will mean returning to Rwanda. Local integration will mean acquiring permanent residency. It is expected that many refugees will choose local integration, as they are either too scared to return to Rwanda or prefer to remain in South Africa because this country has become their new home. Many Rwandan refugees have been in this country for over 15 years and established deep social and economic bonds. In fact, a third of the Rwandan refugees are born in exile and thus lack an historical bond with their country of origin. After 5 years, refugees in South Africa can apply for permanent residency, and many Rwandans have done so, as you will hear. But Home Affairs faces large backlogs in processing applications and isn't likely to be able to deal with the increase of Rwandan applications should it invoke the cessation clause. Rwandan refugees attaining a permanent resident status will lose UNHCR's protection, and the South African government will become solely responsible for them. UNHCR aims to continue to meet the needs of those individuals unable to return to their country of origin for protection-related reasons. According to the Rwandan refugees living in Cape Town, many refugees fear prosecution in Rwanda because they have been outspoken against the new Rwandan government. Because we have got a democracy, we have freedom of speech, freedom of association that refugees have enjoyed in South Africa and do not enjoy in Rwanda. So the fear that if they return because of the weak democracy, they would face prosecution. Simple. UNHCR's strategic plan clearly explains that the cessation clause only counts for refugees who fled Rwanda between 1959 and 1998. Why is Rwanda safe for people who fled the country before 1998, when clearly the country is currently not safe for many other Rwandans? Question mark. UNHCR's strategic plan explains that states will need to determine the timeline for declaring cessation and its subsequent entry into force, and when states that host countries like South Africa, Zambia, DRC, Uganda, Tanzania, Burundi, when states cannot meet the deadline of June 19, 2013, they are advised to suspend the cessation clause until permanent arrangements can be implemented. The South African government can only consider invoking the cessation clause when comprehensive processes for local integration and repatriation can be implemented, securing the safety and well-being of Rwandan refugees. This includes making sure that Rwanda is safe and that there is durable peace. According to the RRCT, many Rwandan refugees want to return to Rwanda someday, but only once it is truly safe to do so. They therefore feel that invoking the cessation clause is premature. The South African government should respond to the cessation clause urgently because the suggested timeline is 30 June 2013. Human Rights Media Centre and Rwandan refugees living in Cape Town recommend that the South African government must not invoke the premature cessation clause and that Rwandan refugees remain protected according to their refugee status and permanent residency applications must be processed in a reasonable period of time. Now, what does this mean in terms of policy? I've got 6 bullets, but I'm adding a 7th while we speak here, and I'm hoping that we can add a few more bullets through our conversations as I'm nearly done and I hand over to my colleagues. So, the first point, as you can see on the board, is that the South African government must consult with stakeholders, especially those who would be most affected by the cessation clause. It could be Angolans, it could be the people from the Democratic Republic of Congo or Burundi. In this case, it's Rwanda. The Scalabrini Centre has been doing very good work, and in the detail of the Angolan cessation clause, it's a pity they didn't have an opportunity to present some of their work that they're doing, but we don't want Rwandans to go through the same pain that Angolans are going through. Responses by the South African government to calls for cessation clauses must be timely. Delays cause additional stress on affected refugees. Third, invoking the cessation clause comes with the responsibility to conduct independent research rather than blindly following recommendations of governments, UNHCR, and other parties. This should not be taken lightly, as the lives of many people depend on it. Fourth, criteria for exemption must be made clear, and it's not clear. There's no criteria. And processes must not compromise the security of applicants. The exemption assessment questionnaire needs revision, as some suggested private and personal information is irrelevant and invades refugees' rights to privacy, dignity, equality, and personal security. Fifth, statistics must be accurate, and I'm very suspicious of statistics generally. I would add to my house. The South African the Department of Home Affairs has a statistic that 1,636 Rwandans are living in South Africa, refugees, but according to the Rwandans living in Cape Town, that's probably more like the population in Cape Town itself. So the question of statistics is very important, and I don't think we've got it right yet, and we must get it right. The next point is that the South African government must define and communicate how long a reasonable period of time it takes to process permanent residence applications. What does this mean, reasonable? Is it 6 months, 20 months, 40 months, 10 years? What is it? Because people have been waiting and waiting, and it's not clear. Then, I'm adding a 7th one to the bullet here, and that is, I think it's really just maybe common decency that when committees send memorandums memorandums to the committee, to the minister, that at least, at the very least, there should be an acknowledgement of receipt of that. Because Rwandan refugees living in Cape Town, the organization, as well as the other organization, Rwandan Platform for Dialogue, Truth and Justice, acronym RDTJ, has sent quite a number of memorandums, and not one has been acknowledged or even responded to. So I think that is a recommendation we would like to make as well. And then I just want to acknowledge as well that the department and the ministry, under Deputy Minister in particular, has been making a concerted effort to engage with refugees. This is a very, very highly appreciated, and in fact we have a meeting this afternoon at 3:30 with her where we will talk about this cessation clause in greater depth. I hope I provided with enough information for us to have a conversation now and for Rwandans to respond to your questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Members, time for your questions and comments. Notice the Honourable Gun, Honourable McIntosh, Honourable Ambrosini, Honourable Matebe, in that order, Honourable Bothman.
Thank you, Jane. Maybe just for the sake of clarity, maybe you can just provide more detail to make it clearer. To us, you indicated that if the cessation clause is invoked, then there are two options for the refugees, either to apply for permanent residency in South Africa or to be repatriated. Then you called on the government not to invoke the cessation clause and said with that that and then the government should process permanent residency permits within a reasonable period of time or something like that. Now, he said, what exactly is the difference? Because in both cases, you're actually suggesting to an extent the same thing, that permanent residency should be, application should be made and processed by the government. I just don't understand how invoking the cessation clause would then make that much of a difference, because they can in any event apply or have already applied for permanent residence. Secondly, you mentioned that those who applied for asylum or got refugee status after 1998, that there's a difference between them and those who applied for it or are indeed refugees or became refugees after 1998. I don't understand exactly what that is all about. Maybe you can just explain that, why there is a difference in terms of how they should be dealt with. And then also as to the question as to how safe Rwanda is actually to return to at the moment. The idea I got from you was basically that there is a bit of a difference of opinion on that question. So who else would differ from you on that point and who agree with you in terms of major international organizations?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for a very, very interesting presentation. One learns something every day. And thank you. I wasn't aware of the cessation clause. I have two questions. I said it's to you and to all the presenters. South Africa, like any other country, has people who apply to come and live here or work here. So they're migrants. They normally have to apply, unless they're tourists, through our consulates. And there's a procedure, and in that, I don't think South Africa is unique at all. Also, we know countries will give skilled people what the Americans call a green card very quickly. The Germans have now introduced the same system for people with very permanent winter, now they'll get permanent residence relatively easily, then effectively our whole system of applying to come and live here and everything's meaningless, because they are effectively arriving as refugees and they simply becoming legalized. Now, I think there's got to be a distinction between asylum and refugees, which I think we've unpacked seriously, and what I would call migrants who come in to work and live in the country. But that is done under a certain procedure. So maybe you'd like to comment on that. The second question, and let me tell you, I've been to Bujumbura twice. I've been to Kigali. I visited the museum in Kigali, the Genocide Museum, and I do have some knowledge of what goes on. But I think the point is, with Honourable Gaum as well, the sense one has is that Rwanda, for whatever reasons, is a stabilised society. Obviously, we hope Somalia is going to do the same so that there can be a cessation clause for Somalis as well. And the economy is very strong in Rwanda. I mean, it's an example to Africa of a strong free market, free enterprise, prosperous country, even though it's small. So what I'm interested in, to get behind it, is when I spoke to some car guards, and I chat to the guys, and I can even speak a bit of Lingala, which is, and also a little bit of Swahili, and I'd been to Kinshasa in November, and I'd interacted with a few prominent politicians there, including some from the eastern provinces, the Kivu area. And when I mentioned to this car guard, who's very well informed, and I mentioned the names, his expression changed, and he said, "That guy's from Rwanda." Now, I happen to know that guy's a Tutsi. But the interesting thing was the response of the car guard, which was a very strong, and coming from KwaZulu-Natal, where we have had some interesting history in clan fighting, it was the reaction of a strong tribalism from that man. And what I think needs to be unpacked openly is, are you, Ms. Gunn, in this group basically representing a Hutu group, or who don't want to go back to Rwanda because it's I don't think it is necessary, but certainly the leader, Mr. Kagame, is of the Tutsi, from the Tutsi community. So I think we need to understand, if that is the problem, why you are very worried, or the people you're representing, which is essentially a Rwandan interest group, that you don't want to go back, or you're not keen on the cessation being stopped. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I stopped in called by a sort of nostalgia, having spent 10 years doing the very type of exercise you are now undertaking, and I promised myself that I was going to keep my mouth shut. I guess my character is not strong enough. And I would like just to make one input, if I may, to take the presentation we receive on a general perspective, which might be of greater value and applicable to the entire situation of refugee affairs as it comes from South Africa. During the 50th anniversary of the protocol to the Geneva Convention on Refugee Affairs, South Africa, under our administration, and Australia found themselves to espouse a position which was at odds with all the other countries of the world, and we were very strange bedfellows. Our hands are very tied when it comes to refugee affairs. There's very little you can do in terms of policy formulation. The law is written down at the international level, and it's an old law. The only standard which doesn't quite apply in Africa is that of well-found fear of prosecution on account of race, political opinions, or religion. The people who come here and they are socio-economic refugee are time caused by enormous disasters, political disasters like the one in Rwanda. It's not that individually they have a well-found fear of persecution if they go back or as a group, but nothing is there. Their rights are not preserved. The most important human right is that of living in under a state which ensures conditions which enable you to eat. I mean, you know, you don't eat, you starve. The rest of the human rights, are not the right of freedom of speech, freedom of religion, come afterward. And in situations in Africa where people cannot survive, talking about the type of human rights protection which was originally designed to ensure the return of Jews after World War II and then extended to everyone else, is an anachronism. And we were trying to deal with modification to the convention. First of all, to expand the definition, because that's what's happening. The refugee system has collapsed because the definition has been expanded by people who do not qualify for refugee status, but they're becoming asylum seekers because they are economic refugees, and they've collapsed the system, and all of them are being pushed forward with these temporary permits constantly renewed. So we need to look, I suggest to the committee, to look at the refugee plight, both in terms of what you can do as a committee in terms of legislation at the domestic level, and both what you can ask the minister and the department to do as they engage in the international structure for a long overdue reform of the international system of refugee affairs and the convention. That was one long point. The other short point, Madam Chairman, we've got 5.7 South Africa, 5.7% of South Africans have been born abroad. I'm one of them. So it's quite a significant group of people who once upon a time were immigrants, refugees, whatever, and they are now South Africans, voting South Africans. Those are the statistics now. In designing a system of how you determine who goes through this journey and for how long and through what stages, because there are different stages. There is permanent, there is temporary, permanent residence, citizenship. It's an entire journey. During our administration, we felt that we had to make it very easy to get to permanent residence, and more difficult to get to citizenship. So you're dealing with a part of the problem, which is getting to permanent residence. But another piece of legislation which is overdue for reconsideration, which we didn't do, and is still the old apartheid legislation, which has been tweaked, but there has not really been policy formulation, is the Citizenship Act. So that you can look at how many of these people can easily get to base one and base two, and perhaps more difficultly to base three. The human rights consideration deal with permanent residence and temporary residence. And the most difficult in other fields but these, all the devils are in the details. And there are lots of details that generalities won't help you. Who do you need? How do you assess whether you need him, and who makes that assessment? These are the three crucial questions. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Matebe. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Mrs. Kam, for presentation. I just want to clarify a question of Angola issue. I think you did not understand what I was trying to say, and the question was raised by then. I was raising question of freedom of movement that we didn't have it. Not situation of all zones for survival of the fittest, no. I was just addressing the situation of freedom of movement and economic empowerment that we didn't have those in Angola in the camps where we kept. And the second one is that what success story of refugee integration into the host communities could be used as a best case scenario for consideration of the upcoming policy debate? Thank you.
consult, and the next thing I told, but those were not the people we were supposed to speak to. So can you just unpack that for us?
Thank you. You may respond, Ms. Kahn.
That Salima is going to address the question. Thanks.
Thanks. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Thank you, committee members, for allowing us with this opportunity to address issues on a cessation clause, especially in case of Rwandan refugees. The first question that I would like to come on is the cessation clause invoking by the UNHCR. It's not the government of South Africa who invoked that cessation clause. The cessation clause is invoked by the UNHCR, which takes place in June this year, the 30th of June this year. That cessation clause will imply for Rwandan refugees, let's say refugees who have refugee status already, they will cease to be refugee in South Africa if the South African government implements that decision clause. But in the meantime, the UNHCR recommends for the host countries to consider also other points, which is mentioned here. They recommend in point one to enhancing promotion of voluntary repatriation and integration of Rwanda refugees in Rwanda. The UNHCR did not just invoke cessation clause and put an end. They recommend the host country to look into those individuals who are not ready to go home for voluntary repatriation, and again, in a 22, they can be integrated, the local integrations. So, what we are saying here is that, following this recommendation, most of refugees who have refugee status, as myself and other community members, we feel and we're going to prove it that our country is still unsafe for us to return back. And we ask the South African government to consider the suggestion made by the UNHCR, which is for those who feel safe for a voluntary repatriation, for those who still need protection to get a local integration, if I can say even a short-term integration, but we believe that the country, our country, is not safe enough for returning home. That's the first question. The second question, which is contradiction with this invocation of the cessation clause, they put two categories of refugees, of Rwanda refugees. The refugees who fled the country from 1959 up to 1998, those are affected by the cessation clause. Those refugees who fled the country 1959 up to 1998, cessation clause is regarding these people. These people must return home. Although those are fleeing now, even today, the cessation clause does not regard them, which is a contradiction. We have seen the country, if the people still running the country up today, we don't understand how you can ask the previous to flee the country to go back while there's still more people running the country. That's the distinction which is making confusion made by the UNHCR. Now, the third question, you ask how safe is in Rwanda. You mentioned that you went to Rwanda, you found Rwanda is a safe country. Of South Africa to host us, but we believe we still have need more time. We don't, like myself, even others, we don't want citizenship. If you can get it, fine. But we still, even a short term, if they can prolong our state, our refugee status, as they used to do 3 or 4 years until the problem of the Great Lake gets unlocked. It's still not safe. It's still not safe. And it's why. And we thank the South African government again through the SADC region. They know what is happening and they determine to unlock the question. For that question of safety of Rwanda, I think it's not time to send Rwanda refugees in their countries, in the Great Lake in as whole. There is still some issues of safety. The question of application to apply for migration or refugees, most of us who are here are affected by the secession clause. We are not any migration, we are refugees and we got the refugee status. So we applied once we entered South Africa, we applied for refugee status and we have them. And we thank the Department of Home Affairs, the South African people, to host us as refugees. But the secession clause, the invocation, if the South African put it in place, that means our refugee status will cease. And we will be forced to return back home. That's why we insist that we can get those refugee status prolonged. The question of you asked Madam Sheila, the director of Human Rights Media Center, which group is representing Sehutu, Tutsi. We are here as Rwanda. We are Hutu and Tutsi. Today, everybody, Hutu, Tutsi are fleeing the country. That, it's a fact. It's not an ethnic group that are fleeing the actual government. It's a whole the country. It's a whole the country. And what's making it bad, even the people who are fleeing the country, the government is following them and kill them outside the country. You got the example in 2010, the former general, the Nyamwasa, attempted murder here in South Africa. It's not the only case. We have many plenty of cases. That was a Tutsi, it's not a Hutu. There are plenty of Tutsi here. My brother's Tutsi, flying the country day and night here in South Africa. If I'm wrong, the Department of Home Affairs can prove it. It's not a question of Hutu or Tutsi. All of us, Rwanda, we are facing unsafe country, unsafe government, and we are fleeing day and night the country. The question of integration, someone asked about integration. The integration, we ask integration according to the suggestion that made by the UNHCR. In the meantime, that we can get our problem solved, and we believe that the problem will be solved. As international community, as the leader of the SADC, are engaged, are determined to unlock the problem of the Great Lake, and the problem of Rwanda will be solved. The last question that need to unpack. The stakeholders, it's us, the affected people. We have seen all these engagements. Once they announced this secession clause, which is affecting us, there was no consultation either from UNHCR or on side of government or home affairs. Instead, we have sent memorandum and report, as my colleague mentioned it earlier. We never received any even acknowledge. So if there is decision that need to be taken upon us, we should be involved and get our views before those decisions are taken. So the stakeholders are the refugees who are affected by this are affected by this secession clause. I think all the questions are answered, and once again I thank the chairperson for the opportunity that given to us, refugee from Rwanda, through the Human Rights Media Center. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for answering those questions. Can we maybe just allow a quick further round of questions before we go on? Is there anyone else who wants to ask a question of or a follow-up? Honourable Kasera?
No, Chair. I'm sure if you had listened to the antithesis of the argument that there is no real challenge in Rwanda, the first impression that one would get from the gentleman when he started responding, you would have thought that no, in fact, this is an economic situation rather than what he termed a political situation. So one needs to then dig deeper to understand the intricacies without looking at what we are actually dealing with here, because we're just scratching the surface here. So that we deal with that issue of the cessation as an issue and engage the ministry and engage the department in dealing with that particular matter. Again, the issue kept coming up around whether we're dealing with the migration policy or some other underlying factors. I think the answer, we are dealing with this migration policy. But there are such pressing matters as this one that needs attention of the committee and, of course, the department and the ministry. So that tripartite engagement ought to take place as a matter of urgency to seek clarity and also guidance as a matter of course in the manner in which we need to engage with those who are affected. So I think that is the approach, Chair, that I would like us to perhaps look into as a committee in this particular one. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I think we can indeed do that. Maybe I can just also, quickly ask clarification again on two issues. You see, I think we are in a difficult position that if a United Nations institution is saying that this particular clause has to be invoked, this is now the United Nations institution dealing with refugee affairs, why should we not allow ourselves to be led by them? It says if, for example, you have the Human Rights Court coming up with a decision, whatever the case might be, and now we start listening to complainants who do not agree with that decision or whatever the case may be. So I think that puts us in a bit of a difficult position. Who should we listen to if we do not listen to and follow the United Nations institution that deals with these matters? And it does still seem to me that refugees are in a position to apply for permanent residence anyway. So why don't they go ahead and do that? And the last matter is those a few last questions and then we can go on to the next presentation. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. In fact, the secession clause invoked by the UNHCR, the same UNHCR put on table suggestion for the host country. Either, and we do respect this suggestion, a voluntary repatriation. Maybe in all of us, some would like to go back home. That is the right, voluntary repatriation. And at the same time, the UNHCR asked for local integration for those who feel the country is still unsafe. And it's where we are looking, as we believe that, and we can prove, and all the international community or the NGOs or human rights, without going into details, have proven that our country is still questionable, the safety of our country is still questionable. It's not ready yet to get the people under protection, go back. And we ask the South African government as a host to allow us to extend our refugee status until the problem is unlocked. And we believe that the problem one day will be unlocked. The question now of two categories of people that must be repatriated from 1959 to 1998, that is confusing us. I think someone from UNHCR, if they are here, they could maybe clarify why the people are running day to day, until today. And for the same reason, why the people before should be repatriated, and those who are coming, they do recognize that people are still fleeing the country. If they still fleeing the country, there is a reason. They are unsafe. Now, why you want to send back the people who fled before? This question, UNHCR should come out and address and answer this question. Why?
Yeah, thank you very much. I don't think there is any.
No, but there is. So many questions. How many people have applied in the jury? And what has been the response?
Yeah. We have applied for many years. All of us who got right to apply for permanent residence, we applied, but it's either about 2 years, 4 years, there is no answer. There is no answer until now. We go through the right channel, we apply, you get a letter that acknowledges that your application has been received, and wait in a reasonable time, you will be answered. Myself, this is 2 years and a half, I never received anything, but that letter that say we received your application and wait, it's 2 years and a half now.
Thank you very much. Yes, I think that last thing that you mentioned now is something that we can follow up from our side as a committee, because we do find we are aware of and has been made aware of the delays within the department pertaining to permanent residency permits, and we find that unacceptable, and we are monitoring the improvements in that regard. So that is something that we can follow up from our side definitely. But let me thank you. I think we've now done
thank you very much. We have to unfortunately go on and have another presentation before we end today. And we do appreciate you coming here. Thank you very much for a very enlightening and interesting presentation that we will also take further to the extent that we can. Thank you very much. Thank you. Next on our list, and last on our list actually, is the International Organization for Migration, the IOM. And we would ask Mr. Bernardo Mariano and his team, he's the regional director, to present to us in that regard. Thank you.
Like brief presentations, and if I my many, many years in many, many countries, I have always seen in many of those countries, all the countries in fact, types of jobs and that are very, very attractive for migrant labor. Not because they are the bottom of the chain, just because either that a certain migration, for instance, from if we talk about Europe, from Portugal to Switzerland, it attracts a certain type of labor force. And in fact, in Southern Africa, if you look at Mozambique, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Botswana, and South Africa, there are some types of labor force that can benefit the economic development. And the question is how we can have a framework that will allow my brother that lives at the border, city or even inside in the countryside, to actually regularly, legally come to South Africa, work, and go back home. So contribute to the development of both countries and for the person itself. And what we promote as the International Organization for Migration is a policy, and it is evidence that is evidence-based migration policy, which has the migration governance, which looks at the migration impact, the trends and the migrant characteristics, and the international cooperation. In fact, because migration it cannot be handled only by one entity, even from the humanitarian players, neither from the state perspective nor from the department perspective. I think that it creates its own challenge and intricacy that needs to be that holistic approach makes a difference between success or failure. I'll take you through the topics that are there. Basically, I'll just have a brief introduction on IOM, and I'll talk about South African migration issues and trends, broad policy issues, some thematic policy issues, and the conclusion. For those who know who don't know, IOM is a 149 member states and 12 observers. Basically, an intergovernmental organization, headquartered based in Geneva, 450 offices around the world, 5,400 staff, and $1.3 billion budget that we have on different operations. And I'm honored and very glad to be here, but also to see this initiative taking shape, because we have done and we have supported several governments in establishing their national migration policy. The case of Nigeria, Ghana, Burundi, Uganda. We have worked with IGAD. We are doing discussions with SADC. We have worked with the Africa Union on migration policy framework, and then the African Common Position for Migration and Development. And in Europe, Ireland, we've supported the government of Ireland to establish their national migration policy. So this is it is for me. I'm very happy to see this development taking shape. Of course, when you look at the migration policy, you look at the different areas of migration. I think some honourable members did mention today that okay, we're talking about migration, or are we talking about economic migrants, or are we talking about refugees affairs, or asylum seekers. I think perhaps there are some issues that are very much on top of others in terms of relevance or life-saving situation, but doesn't mean that migration is only about that. In fact, the economic migration, we have migration for reasons on the same group. How it's no longer that this group is a group of refugees, it's a mixed flow, so that it poses some challenge in terms of how to, first of all, distinguish refugees and asylum seekers from economic migrants, second of all, apply different instruments and then international mechanisms that the can subscribe to for each one of these groups, and there's of course the national immigration law on that. And indeed, we have high visible cases like Gulf of Aden, Canary Islands, and then a lot of stories that you might have read in the newspaper of migrants, of mixed flows from Mozambique, in Zimbabwe, or in Tanzania. And they are mainly Ethiopian Somalis traveling through Nairobi in Kenya, and Tanzania, Malawi, into South Africa. South Africa is not the final destination only, it's both. It's the final destination and it's also transit. These flows, we have data that shows that part of this flow is seen in South America moving towards the U.S., so through Mexico and forward. So of course, the majority stays here, but a percentage that move to Europe and to the U.S. Migration trends in South Africa is historical. I mean, when I talk to some friends and colleagues, I always joke of how do you define being a South African? Is it the ones who great parents migrated 500 years ago, or the ones 100 years ago? I think the question of a good citizenship for those who either were born here, those that migrated centuries ago, and those who migrated recently, I think that's the center of the trend to understand the migration policy. And of course, understanding the pull and push factor is important. We have high level of circular migration in South Africa, and internal migration as well. I think it's an area that we tend to not pay attention, but and that's why I mentioned that my first experience of migration happened when I moved from my village to the provincial capital, and I'm sure most of us, if not all of us, are either migrants or child of migrants. The colleague from Salaga mentioned here that in terms of the percentage of migrants, international migrants, but there are the internal migration in South Africa, you can see from the map, so basically maybe you cannot read, but the darker means the higher percentage. So there are some poles of concentration of internal migrants where they go basically to Gauteng province. It's, I think, the highest city of Johannesburg is definitely the highest, and even in the other parts of the country. International migration according to the data from the United Nations Economic and Social Development, South Africa's share of migrants is 3.7%. So, as was mentioned before, statistics are always debatable, and the statistics about migrants is debatable. But what remains correct is that international migrants is a small subset of South Africa population. We think that within the migration policy. how the control impacts economically South Africa. It is something that needs to be discussed. And then, of course, as I said in the beginning, if the migration policy is designed and implemented by only one agency and without consultation with the others, which I'm happy to see this consultation happening, I think we will have some negative impacts, and then which will, can even fuel the fact that, okay, these, we have to put more control. I'll not go through all the specific policy objectives that we recommend, but definitely I'll just because of because of time constraint, I will highlight some of them. Attract investors, skilled workers, and tourists. Deliver transparency for efficient travel documents for South African nationals. I think those are some of the issues that we believe that should be a core part of the South Africa migration policy. We need to look into how we can contribute to the security and stability of the country through border management and control of foreigners in South Africa territory, prevent and combat irregular migration, in particular the smuggling of migrants and trafficking of persons. Because when there is a route of irregular migrants, like the one of mixed flows, that route that brings regular migrants brings a lot more than people. It brings drugs, can bring traffic, people can bring other elements because basically they go through, they create a path that is unchecked. We had a situation where we support the government of Mozambique to assist some of this mixed flow between the border of Mozambique and Tanzania, and the smugglers came to us, saying, what are you doing? You're taking the business away from us. We make money out of these people. They pay us to take them to the next point. So it is a lucrative business for the smuggling network. Now, we can actually sit and do nothing or try to look at ways to minimize that by creating perhaps some regular channels that will allow the governments to control who comes and who goes and who stays and who overstays and whatnot. Of course, we need to harness the potential of the cooperation of South African diaspora towards national development. That's migration development again. That part of the policy should be included. The data. Migration data is one of the biggest challenges in this region. I remember when I met with the minister, former minister of Foreign Affairs, Mr. Zuma. Look, we can actually open our borders and allow our neighboring countries to cross, but we need to know who is from that country. We don't want somebody who came from Pakistan to Lesotho and got Lesotho documents and comes to South Africa and say, I'm from Lesotho, or goes to Mozambique and say, come to South Africa with a fake Mozambican passport. So it is not an issue that can be addressed at only interdepartmental. I think my first slide conclusions alluded to that. It is as well something that needs to be discussed at the regional level. Of course, the promotion of the regional integration through ratification of SADC protocol, I think that's one of our policy elements that we're working with SADC and the member states here in the SADC region to really get that protocol in place. Therefore, on the thematic areas of policy consideration, we need to look at border management, travel document frauds, migration development, including labor migration and diaspora, in migration for education, migration for tourism. I was the other day crossing. I travel a lot and I use a lot on Tambo, and one of the immigration officials said, look, I'm bringing somebody here to do tourism, so it's good for the country. They say, no, and it's not good because he claims the tax back. Say that perhaps more awareness of how South Africa is gaining, it is important to consider. I mean, if you, for those who have gone to Thailand, you see how the Thai government actually makes tourism, as I mentioned before, and diaspora engagement. I think we have, globally, you know that remittances, it's more than of the official government aid, perhaps in terms of policy element in that area should be how these remittances can be channeled for development. I think that's important. And as one element, that's what we do. One activity that we implement together with SADC and the member states in SADC is a dialogue in Southern Africa. And we had in 2010, we had a first ministerial meeting bringing all the ministers of home affairs in the SADC region. I don't know if honorable members you are aware, but there is no forum in SADC that brings the ministers of home affairs to discuss migration. Because in the SADC, immigration is under the police organ of peace and security. When the police organ meets, most of the people that go there are ministers of defense. And as a result, migration itself is basically put to the second stage. So we are working with SADC to actually bring that element. And in fact, this year we agree with SADC to hold the second ministerial meeting in Mozambique to bring all the ministers of home affairs and all the ministers of labor to discuss labor migration in the region. So in addition to the thematic areas I mentioned, of course, migration and security, migration and health, migration and environment, international and regional cooperation, migration and human rights, migration data and information management are important cross-cutting issues to include in this migration policy. I just want to thank Madam Chair and the honorable members of the committee for this opportunity that you have given to us to present. And we remain available for further discussion to either provide more inputs, but also to work together with staff and government to bring about a very strong national migration policy. I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mariano. It was a good input, though I didn't get it at the beginning. But I get it when you were dealing with, actually knowing the movement of people as to where a person is, what he is doing, what permit he or she has. We visited the country last year where we were going to actually look at such policies. That's Russia. They have a good system where they are able to trace each and every member or a refugee or an immigrant who is in their system. They're able to see where she or he is, whether he's got a permit or not, and if the permit is in process, they're able to trace all that. So that is why we were coming with we want to come with this issue of moving reception centers to borders, because that's what they are having. Each and every person who enters Russia goes through a border post. You are registered there, you make your application, you do everything there. After that, then you enter the country. You are in the system, you are known. If your details are in process, it's stated you are still in process, but there is monitoring. So that is our wish, that one day we will see ourselves having such a system as South Africa. Honorable members, that was an input from the Migration Agency. Questions and comments? Honorable Marcella, Honorable McIntosh, Honorable De Freitas, Honorable Bosman, in that order.
Thank you, Chair President, and much thanks to the presenter from the IOM. We normally read about the good work that you continue to do and aspire to in the region, in the world. But I started some questions. One is the, what is, in your view, lacking in our immigration regime, and how do you think that could be, you know, changed in order to make it what you would call the better system that works? Because some of the concerns that you've raised is that we should make our system a socio-economic and politically correct in order to accommodate all the demands or all the suggestions and concerns that you are putting forward as an institution. So I would, one would then appreciate a suggestion or an advice in that fashion. I've read that in 2011 you released a report that shows that between 1974 and 2009 worldwide public concern rates regarding immigration has gone from just over 20% of the population to almost 50%, and that in some countries the perceived presence of foreigners seems to be more than the locals. And that then talks to countries like Italy, Spain, the US, and Canada, for an example. Meaning that it is possible that in a country you end up having foreigners being a majority where they take control, like in these countries, if you look at the real numbers. Now, is that something that South Africans should be worried about? Because you also state in that report that the xenophobic violence is not actually immune in other countries. For instance, one country in Greece, in Europe, there's been violence there, and South Africa has been a good example to showcase how this violence has erupted, not only in some quarters, but in the world in general. Now the question, Chair, do you think South Africa should be worried about this phenomenon that you just highlighted here? And what is, in your view, the best mechanism to curb this kind of worry or the growing concern in the communities that when you come in, you take my job, when you come in, you take my space? How do one harmonize and ensure that there is synergies between what you are continuously propagating against that which the communities perceive, so that as government we can send that sign, that kind of message, and obviously as parliament that says to people, look, don't worry about these things because this is what will work eventually. But what we're getting here in this report, it says everywhere else people are worried. Now the question is, why should South Africa not be worried when it comes to the growing numbers that might overwhelmingly become the majority of the locals? I've seen also in Germany being worried about the tax and what tensions that creates. But I think I'm trying to solicit an advice and opinion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's, I'm learning a lot. I never knew there was such an organization, and what a sensible, practical organization and presentation you have. Can I just go to your migration statistics page? May I say it's good to know that you keep these statistics. Just purely for your interest, the South African census, which admittedly was done a year after what you reckon in terms of international migrants, says there are 1.7 million in South Africa, not the number you put. But it's still close enough. It's a good ballpark figure. And my question is, I don't quite understand annual, the very bottom, you've got the annual rate of change of migration stock. Can you just explain to me what that is, that statistic? Another question, unfortunately, my present document, I don't have that map of sort of Southeast Africa where you show the migration routes, which is very interesting that you have that information. One of the concerns which we've heard and which didn't come out in that map, or I didn't have long enough time to study it, but a hard fact is that people are getting visas to enter Mozambique, and then they come into Swaziland, and then they cross the border into South Africa. Now, my question is, are you aware of that? Secondly, are you aware of, and this is only anecdotal evidence, that people fly into Lesotho, and I gather it particularly applies to Asian irregular immigrants, I like this word, irregular migrants, it particularly applies to them, who then come to Maseru, and then they have a means to enter South Africa, either smuggled or illegally. And I just appreciate perhaps a comment on that, and also, furthermore, that the suggestion is that a number of people are landed on the shores, the beaches of Mozambique, and then they walk through. So, with no respect to you as the presenter, sir, but it sounds to me as though Mozambique is a problem in terms of irregular migrants, let's call it that. And then I suppose after all these presentations, I almost am getting a new definition for colonialism. Perhaps colonialism should be called old-fashioned migration. But anyway, that's just a frivolous comment.
So indeed, this is a good presentation. At least it helps us to pick up on issues that we need to attend to. But I'm just wondering, according to the stats that's presented in this document, in 1990, there were no refugees or any number of refugees that entered the country. And I understand the situation there. But immediately after the democratic government in 1995, immediately you have that huge number that comes in as refugees. What could be the reason behind that? We would understand that it might, but it has a bearing if we can be clarified in terms of your understanding, the reason behind that. Thank you.
Honorable Defritas, do you have your hand?
Thank you, Chair. I've been covered with some of my colleagues, just outstanding questions is the map, which I find very interesting. If you could just perhaps unpack and tell us where this information, what this is based, this information, because it's the kind of information that Home Affairs himself don't seem to have. And then also a similar question to I've asked before, and that is your interactions with the Department of Home Affairs. Have you had any interaction? Have you approached them or vice versa? And what's the outcome? Because I presume that you are available and keen to interact with them. I just want to just thank you for the presentation. It's added a new dimension to these hearings. Thank you very much.
Thank you, honourable members. Over to you, Mr. Mbeno, and your colleague, of course.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will attempt to answer some questions to my best knowledge, of course, and I will use my colleagues to support and who are experts. Perhaps the first question is, what's lacking in South Africa total population of migrants. I think if you look at the trend of migrants, it's been around mainly in the past, let's say 20 or even 50 years. It's never above 5%. But if you look at Johannesburg as a one, let's say, city, or you look at Geneva for those who have been in Switzerland, or even Dubai, those are centers of migrants where the population, local population, is lower than the migrant population. I'm not saying the general is the case, but Switzerland has 60% of foreign nationals in Geneva and 40% of locals. In Dubai, it's a similar situation. In Johannesburg, it's not yet, but on the other hand, the statistics, and I'll get to the statistics, I call them guesstimates, because most of it, we rely on regular migration, where there's a large number of irregular migration. So I could multiply the 1.7 million by 2, by 3, and some could multiply even by 5 or by 10 or by 5 to make it 10 million to 10 million migrants. But unless we work in the data collection to get quality data, so we will be we're missing part of the real number. Should South Africa be worried about overpopulation of migrants? The answer is no. South Africa shouldn't be worried about overpopulation of migrants. I don't think you have a situation of more migrants in South Africa than the local South Africans, unless the South Africans stop making children. And if they stop, the migrants will make children, and those children are South Africans. So it will still be counted as South African. So therefore, I don't think that there is that situation where South Africa should be worried of overpopulation. Of course, there are centers and places where the migrant population will be much, much higher percentage. As long as, and the Honorable Madam Chair said, I can rush it, if there is control and the state knows who is in, where is the person, that remains, this overpopulation is not an issue at all. In Switzerland, it's not an issue. In Dubai, it's not an issue. In fact, it's an economic power, and they want more people to come. So that's one area that I think the immigration policy needs to be strong, and then having a strong implementation mechanism. And the best mechanism, of course, I'm also being generalist here, is that like in the U.S. and many other developed countries, they have quota systems. How many, let's say, migrant labor force for different types they want to have each year, and they create mechanisms for people to come regularly through that. Of course, if the push factor and the pull factors are higher, it tilts the balance. Therefore, the role of South Africa in relation to regional integration cannot be overlooked, because there's no point in having a great policy and great monitoring mechanism when from your neighbor there is a push factor that actually pushes thousands or millions of people to your country. So that the role of South Africa in the region has to be hand in hand with your policy in South Africa in terms of migration policies. So the best mechanism is basically to have that migration policy that will look at quotas. I mean, how many unskilled labor for different sectors the country needs, and how is that being actually implemented? Because it's good to have a document saying that we need, 10,000 doctors or 20,000 nurses, and then when you look at how in 5 years how many doctors and nurses you got, it's very, very, I mean, to 1% or 2%. So that then it means that the policy is good, and the response or the implementation is not so good. But I think it touches also this gap between the government policy and acceptance by the public of that particular policy. It requires a mechanism that allows the government to pass on the message, and that's why I gave the example of my experience, latest experience at Otambo Airport, where the in the ordinary on one honorable member mentioned, okay, we don't want the terrorists, we don't want the criminals, we don't want, so that those are the, some of the risks that needs to be mitigated. On the migration statistics, Mukwan, you want to answer that? On the change, migration stock.
Answer the question.
question about the Mozambique being the problem. I think Mozambique has been a problem for South Africa for quite a long time, since during the apartheid, when so Mozambique was hosting the ASC. It was a problem for the South African government at that time, and now it's piloting having being a transit country. The point is, I think it's not whether Mozambique is the problem or Pakistan or Bangladesh is the problem. The question is what can be done to actually address that. And if the problem is Mozambique or Lesotho, then what can South Africa do? Because in fact, as I mentioned before, Mozambique can look at that problem individually. And maybe even we have it that, okay, it's just a transit. But I come from a province called Nampula. And then when I visited the last time, I couldn't recognize. The social structure of the city's changed. Lots of Somalis and Ethiopians and Nigerians and all that, and doing small trade. So I think in the, my question is, what is the state gaining out of it? If you don't regularize, they don't pay taxes, and they the government doesn't get anything. And then on the other hand, if there's no system to actually integrate them, it creates animosities and the local population starts to against the foreigners. So I think the question is what needs to be done, not only in the transit country, because you can actually ask Mozambique to close the borders and then put a patrol the sea waters of Mozambique. That will not stop irregular migration. They will always find routes, and because it's an international smuggling network that operates very efficient. And unless the government actually bring work together, we will have problems. Look at the Somalia and the piracy. So it requires governments to work together to address this problem. Indeed, they are, as I said in my presentation, Mozambique, Tanzania, Lesotho, Swaziland, they are both transit and destination countries. Small percentage stay, big percentage transit. South Africa, there's a big percentage that stays and small percentage transit goes to Europe and the U.S. As Mozambique is the problem for South Africa, so that will be the problem for U.S. and for European countries. So I think the question is, how do you address that? I think there was a question on colonialism or migration. It is debatable. I think the point is people moved. They became citizens of where they move into. They are nationals of those countries. Now, what reason and why they move, that's the thing that I don't think we... I'm equipped to debate and discuss that. The point is that, because now if you look at Australia, how was Australia created? It was a migration from Europe and mainly UK. Those are the dynamics. So there's reasons of people moving. Some forced, some due to economic reasons or war or other policy elements that were applied in the past, including colonialism, which created a diversity in the world. And I think that's what we need to deal with, is the diversity in our community, which we need to see how we can address that. I think I answered the question of where the map comes from, so that we are really ready to provide that. And in the interaction with the Department of Home Affairs, I think we have a good interaction with the Department of Home Affairs. South Africa being a member state of IOM, I think last year the deputy minister Fatima went to our council meeting. We had a very good follow-up meeting. There were a couple of initiatives that we are working together to see how we can help the government of South Africa to address some of the challenges, including irregular migration. We think through that visit, in fact, the South Africa delegation looked at the assisted voluntary return. How do you create a system where, instead of deporting, which costs a lot of money, to create a process where people would say, look, I'm opting to go back. And there are some models that we did discuss. On the jump from the 1990 to 1995, what I can answer is basically I can provide you with what we call the World Migration Report, which then explain my little more in detail. I personally didn't look at the why that jump. Of course, in 1990, perhaps the humanitarian community, international community, was not present in South Africa, and in 1995, suddenly this were there because everybody came back to operate in South Africa. So that's perhaps most the result of the political situation at that time than the actual number of refugees. So I don't think it means that there was no refugee in 99, but basically there's no information for that. But we can provide the World Migration Report, which we publish every year, to that would distill a little bit more of that type of information. Thank you, Honorable Madam Chair.
Thank you. Honourable members, I don't see any more hands. I'm sure we're all exhausted and we have come to the end of our meeting. I want to thank IOM for your input and knowledgeable input, and we are going to be engaging